Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio Houston with our hosts from Children at Risk, noted child activist Dr. Bob Sanborn, and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Mandy?
It's good to have a little sound.
Are we here? I can't hear myself.
Well, I can hear it. Can you hear yourself now?
Hello. Yes,
there
I
you
can.
Go. Yeah. Happy Monday, Mandy.
Happy Monday. We're going with it.
Yeah, at least we had the intro music, right?
So that's
that was
right.
Good.
Yeah,
that's
very good.
So, Mandy, I understand that we have millions of people online listening to us as well.
That's right.
So I'm excited.
It's wonderful.
That, right?
I talk to a lot of people who listen to us online.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Your dad and mom listen to us online, don't they?
They do. All the way from Louisiana.
And they love, I mean, I understand that they're big fans of Dr. Bob, but they're so about their daughter on the air.
I mean,
is it vice versa, actually,
I'm
right?
Probably the favorite.
Yeah, I think so.
In that household.
I think so.
The rest of the world, I give you the spotlight.
No, it's all about you, Mandy. We know that. We've known that for a long time. So how are the kids doing, by the way, your kids?
They are wonderful.
We're talking about growing up in America, so you have some kids growing up, right?
I have some kids growing up, and the exciting news was last week Mason got his hearing aid.
Oh, yeah.
And
your little boy got
yes.
his hearing aid. So now he hears everything?
Now he can hear everything. Be careful.
So I wanted to ask you about this, Mandy. All the news last week, right, about sexual assault and so forth, and it seemed to be filling up the news. How do you protect your kids around that? Because that's a deal, isn't it? I mean, everyone's talking about it. The news is talking about it. And I felt like the same thing, you know, back in the day when they talked about Monica Lewinsky. It was the same thing, you know. How do you talk to your kids about this? I
mm-hmm.
mean, are your boys, do they have any questions or...
So they do not have any questions, and I try to limit their exposure
yeah.
to it, right?
Yeah.
So in the car or on television, I don't want them to hear it. However, I do feel that it's important to talk about healthy relationships, right?
Yeah.
And so it just so happens my kids are in Cub Scouts.
Yeah.
And so there's this Cub Scout book. I'm new to this. I'm learning as I go,
mm-hmm.
right? But one of the first things it talks about is healthy relationships and child to adult, like what's appropriate,
yeah.
what's not, how to be careful. And so those are the conversations that we're having right now.
I was up in Fort Worth last week, and I made a speech on human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that was asked of me was around parents and what should parents do. And, you know, you and I have talked about this whole idea of demand. You know,
mm-hmm.
why is it that boys will be boys in terms of purchasing, right, trafficking victims? And we talked a lot about parents and sort of their responsibility in teaching boys. Because a lot of times when parents think about trafficking, they think it's all about trying to protect the girls, right?
Right.
But really, in ending demand, it's all about teaching boys how to be proper young men, right? And how to treat women and
That's
have
right.
those relationships, right?
Healthy
so.
Relationships, respect.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
Yeah, sort of an interesting deal, right?
It is.
Yeah. So anyway.
It's unfortunate that we have to keep having these conversations, but
we
the
do.
Reality is that we will keep having them.
We will keep mm-hmm. having them. So, hey, on the program today, we have, we're going to have, what's his name? We're going to have David McLean. No, who is it? Who's the director of the Center for Child Health Research? Oh, that's Jenny Iyer. That's Jenny Iyer. So you see, she's sort of hidden there. So Jenny Iyer from our Dallas office, from the Dallas Office of Children at Risk and the director of the Center for Child Health Research and Policy is going to be here. Mandy, the number today.
Mm-hmm.
Three.
Mm-hmm. That's a fun number.
That's the number.
That sounds like a lucky number almost.
Kings at Christmas mm-hmm. time. Three kings.
That's true.
What about three kids? Three children? No, two children.
So after Date Ahead, we're going to talk to Chanel Brown, Children at Risk, AmeriCorps Vista, and she'll be joining us today and talking about what they're doing around Hurricane Harvey recovery. And
yeah,
they were on last week,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Chanel is here. She's from Dallas. She lives in Houston. She's working exclusively on Hurricane Harvey recovery for a whole year. She just started recently, so it'll be interesting to talk with her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's sharp. We're also going to be talking with Zenobia Lai, and she is the program director for Catholic Charities, the Cabrini Center, the St. Francis Cabrini Center for Immigrant Legal Assistance. She'll be giving us an update on the on immigrant children at the border.
Yeah.
Interesting talking to Zenobia.
And then today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in if you can. We might have some technical difficulties here, right? There might not be a lot of calling in. However, our thumbs up, thumbs down is allowing your children to fly by themselves. Is it okay for kids, young kids, to fly on airplanes
when
by
themselves? When you were a kid, did you ever fly by yourself, Mandy? Did you have to, I had to do that when I was a young kid. Yeah,
I remember doing it in first grade.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. did? And so, what, you had a flight attendant helping you out and mm-hmm. everything, right? I think
kind of felt like I was VIP.
I think there's less of that now, though, right? Because more kids actually fly alone. Mm-hmm. And so, the flight attendants sort of pay a little bit of attention. I guess it depends who you're going to get.
Yeah, I think it depends.
And
I mean, clearly there's an issue.
You know what I mean? Should it depend on how good? Right, it shouldn't, right?
Well, and I mean, and
we live in a society where people travel.
I guess my question is, before we even, you know, get into this, before you let your kid fly, I mean, what are their policies and what are the expectations that you can hold them accountable to, mm-hmm. right?
I wonder if you have to pay more when your children fly alone.
You do.
You do? Mm-hmm. You know this?
I think so. And maybe it depends on the airlines. I'm not quite sure.
I bet you, right? I bet you that's part of it as well. Well, that should be interesting. Thumbs up, thumbs down. And there's that interesting story, which we'll talk about. What was Frontier Airlines where this happened and was like a big old deal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a big old deal.
Yeah, it was. Our final guest for the hour today will be Ryan Rampoul. Ryan is the Senior Project Manager for Government Relations at Texas Children's Hospital. And he's going to be talking to us a little bit about key things that are happening in regards to health in mm-hmm. our community, right? We always love talking to people over at Texas Children's.
That's right.
Well, we had Dr. Bikini's from Texas Children's, so we love having her on the program as well. So, so it should be a good show.
That's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Mandy, you ready for a little data head?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Ha! So on the line with us is Jenny Iyer. Jenny, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are y'all?
Very good. Jenny is the director of the managing director of our Dallas office, the North Texas office for children at risk, and she's the head of our Center for Child Health Research and Policy.
That's right.
That's always a mouthful, that Center for Child Health, Jenny.
It is.
Well, that's great. It's great to hear your voice, Jenny. I know you've been really busy talking about health these days. A lot of great opportunities coming our way, hopefully.
Hopefully.
No.
So, Jenny, what is the big number for the day?
The big number today is 3.
3. I was saying, number 3 is a lot of people's lucky number.
That's true.
Yeah. Is that your lucky number, Jenny?
It is one of mine.
So that's not the right answer, though, right?
Unfortunately, no. That's not the right answer.
So what is the right answer?
So the right answer is that 3 represents the number of meals children in HISD are getting for free this year every single day.
That's the Houston Independent School District?
Yes, sorry, Houston Independent School District. Those students are getting, every student is getting 3 meals a day for free.
So there are about, there are over 200,000 children in Houston, here in Houston, in the school district. And does that mean that every single one of those kids, I guess they all have the option of getting 3 meals, right?
They do. Most of them do. And I know the dinner program is relatively new. I think they're working to expand that to more schools. But pretty much everyone is going to be able to have the opportunity for 3 meals.
Wow. So talk to us a little bit more about this, because school lunch, right, has always had great participation in regards to eligible kids participating in the free or reduced price lunch, right? And then school breakfast, HISD, probably almost, a decade ago, decided that they were going to offer universal school breakfast to increase those participations. But what's going on with dinner, and how does that look?
Sure. So dinner is a newer program and is available to all schools that have at least 50% of their kiddos qualifying for a free or reduced meal. With Houston ISD, they just went into the community eligibility program provision, which basically means that now every child doesn't have to fill out a form to be eligible for a meal. Everyone's going to get a free meal, and that means that dinner kind of gets expanded to every school as well, since the community eligibility provision allows for that. So supper allows for kids who might go home to an empty refrigerator or empty pantry to get an after-school meal before they go home. And the great thing about the supper program is that it has to be paired with an educational enrichment program. So kids have the opportunity to stay after school, to get after-school tutoring, or be a part of maybe a chess club or something else that's offered at the school, and they get a meal as well. So it's a great program.
So, Jenny, when we look across the country, how many urban districts in the United States are doing this idea of three meals a day for their kids?
You know, I would say not enough.
Yeah.
I'm not certain of that specific number.
It's right.
Hopefully always increasing, but not enough schools are taking advantage of it.
And they don't have to pay for this, right? I mean, by and large, the U.S. Department of Agriculture provides everything for this, right?
That's right. That's right. The only kind of hurdle that it takes, so I guess there's two hurdles. It's actually a different application process, so school districts have to apply, take that first step,
yeah,
and say, we want to serve this, and then they have to have that enrichment piece.
Yeah, that's right.
Serve a meal without it.
But which is a good thing.
But we know, right, we know the longer school day, the time on task, and making sure that your food's secure, all that is going to make for higher academic performance.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I just want to be clear, this is a great opportunity for students who need, who are hungry, right?
Yeah.
And families who need that extra support. However, and the percentage of children that are economically disadvantaged in HISD in Houston Independent School District is
about 80%.
About 80%.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a lot. Then there's the 20%, right, who might not be in need as much, but they're probably very close. And so I guess I'm saying all of this, though, it's not required and it's not mandatory, right? So there are families out there, if they don't need this program, it's not like there's going to be a bunch of waste or that dollars are being spent poorly.
Well, that 20%, I mean, there's a significant portion of that that has no need at all, right?
Right.
I mean, these are families, they're doing fine. But yeah, they can just say no and move on, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't. The idea is it's not going to necessarily have an impact on your kids, but you want to make sure that the 80% who needs it
right.
gets to use it. Hey, Jenny, while we have you here, I wanted to ask you, I know that some of the biggest hurdles for breakfast and dinner are high schoolers, right? How do you make sure, though, that if I'm a kid at high school and I'm food insecure, but of course I don't want to admit that I'm a poor kid. How do you make sure that those kids grab a breakfast and aren't going down to the cafeteria to be the poor kid who's getting food, or going to the cafeteria afterwards to get food? And because, you know, when you're in high school, I remember when I was in high school, now I was happy to go get my free school lunch, but I know there were a lot of kids who really didn't want to admit that we were poor.
You know, high school is a conundrum for so many districts, because not only is that stigma much more impactful at that age, a lot of these schools also either start really, really early, and so their kids aren't really hungry when the school day begins.
Mm-hmm. They're not awake.
Or they start late, and they go, kids will stop by the gas station as they're walking to school. So it's difficult for high school campuses to really have a robust program. But I will say, there are some wonderful programs out around the San Antonio area. You've got districts in the 90% participation, and I think that is an example of kids growing up with a breakfast program, breakfast
yeah.
in the classroom. They have breakfast in the classroom K through 12 in some of those districts. And so they're used to it. They don't need to go elsewhere because they know it's going to be there, and that's just something they've been doing since kindergarten.
And breakfast in the classroom, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's coming to you.
And the kiosks.
Yeah, and then
grab
and go. I think other schools are trying to find innovative ways to bring those high schoolers in. So they're looking at having smoothies, and having
yeah.
coffee bars, and making breakfast really fun and creative so that kids want to come, and maybe they grabbed, you know, an Egg McMuffin or a donut, but they're having an opportunity for second chance breakfast, so they're getting it after second period, and when they're still a little bit hungry and want to grab something. So you just have to be creative, but there's ways to make it happen.
And you and I were at the Dallas School District, and we saw they were doing a lot of smoothies, right? That was a big deal for them to do those smoothies.
They do. I got to taste them, and if I was a high school student, I would be having multiple smoothies every morning.
That's the end thing. Smoothies. All your nutrients right there in a gulp.
Right in there.
Exactly.
Big gulp. So Mandy does. Hey, Jenny Iyer is the managing director of the North Texas Children at Risk office, serving Dallas, Fort Worth, and environs. And she's also the director of the Center for Child Health Research and Policy. Thank you, Jenny, for all that you do. Thank you for being on the program.
Thanks. Y'all have a great show.
Alrighty, thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So we want to thank Jenny for that. Are you ready to get into Chanel Brown?
I am.
Yeah, me too. I really am too. Wow. Chanel, are you there with us?
I am.
Very good. Hey, did you choose that music yourself, Chanel?
I did. I had to give some R-A-S-P-E-C-T to the queen.
There you go. Right. So, Chanel, you've been in Houston now for what, about 2 months?
About a month.
A month. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. And you've come here specifically to work on Hurricane Harvey recovery?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And how has that been for you coming here? And I know you've toured a lot of areas. You've been to a lot of meetings. And what is your first, what's your first thought? I mean, here you are, you're AmeriCorps, Vista, coming here specifically to work on this. And as you assess the situation, what are you seeing?
Yeah, so when I first got to the Houston area, I just had a basic knowledge of Harvey in Houston. I had watched the news, I had seen the devastation, but from pictures or from just stories, and I guess how the news just wasn't talking about Harvey in Houston anymore, I kind of just assumed that the Houston area had just gotten back on its feet and everyone was in the same sort of direction in terms of the recovery process. However, now I've gotten to the Houston area and now I've joined Children at Risk and done more research regarding that. And I mean, it's the complete opposite. There are still so many people, so many homes that are still in devastation. There are so many people who still just need to get back on their feet and are still displaced from their homes. So it was just an eye-opening experience just coming from Arlington to the Houston area.
Chanel, how did you get here? What was it that made you want to be proactive or involved in Hurricane Harvey recovery?
So this is my second year as an AmeriCorps Vista. My first year was at an organization called Academic Success Program Dallas, and they did a lot of college access stuff. And then I had thought about grad school and public policy. However, I thought that I didn't have the right amount of experience. So I decided to look into other AmeriCorps programs and just tried to see if there was more of a research component with one of the AmeriCorps affiliated organizations. And I think that's how I came to Children at Risk, because in the description, it talked a lot about research and how we would be researching different Hurricane Harvey related materials. And that just really interested me, especially since I wanted to get my master's in public policy.
Wow. And Chanel, I know, being from the Dallas area, when I go up to Dallas, it always seems like they have this big there's this big rivalry with Houston, right?
Oh yeah.
And I'm not sure that in Houston we know there's a rivalry, but in Dallas they really believe there's this rivalry. And I'm wondering...
Oh, I don't think that Houston is left out of that.
Oh, no? You think there's plenty of that? Okay, that's good to know. So how does it feel for you, though, to come down here? I mean, there's a rivalry, it's a friendly rivalry, I guess, right? I mean, but how does it feel to be down here and working in Houston? And what sort of differences do you see between the two cities?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. There's definitely a rivalry between Dallas and Houston. Right before I moved to Houston, I just had this kind of immediate hatred towards it. just because I was in the Dallas area, and then Dallas thinks they're so much better than Houston, and then Houston thinks they're so much better than Dallas. But I got here, and I mean, I feel like I've truly been welcomed. Mm-hmm. Some of the differences is it's so big. It's just very, very big. I'm still trying to learn what's considered in the loop, what's considered out of the loop, beltway.
There's lots of loops.
Right, exactly. And then the traffic is definitely something that has been a bit of an adjustment.
Wow.
Dallas has traffic.
Yeah, yeah, that's different, though.
I feel like it's kind of different. It kind of is.
I think you know, I try to have this open view. I think Dallas is a prettier city, right? But Houston is way bigger, and it seems like Houston wears diversity on its sleeve a little bit more than Dallas does, right?
I mean, yeah, I would say so. And again, just kind of another difference that I'd seen is just kind of how, again, everybody tends to support everybody. Again, I saw a lot of that in the news in terms of Harvey, and I feel like there's still a lot of that going on right now, just a lot of Houstonians just supporting other Houstonians. So that's really nice to see.
Chanel, the legislative session starts in January, mm-hmm. and with you and a group of other people solely focused on Hurricane Harvey, what are you hoping to be able to highlight in regards to the needs of Houstonians and others in Texas that are recovering from the hurricane?
Yeah. So one of the things that I think we would really like to highlight is just, again, how devastated certain communities still are. And then the disparities between how affluent neighborhoods in the Houston area have recovered versus lower income neighborhoods, how they are just still recovering, still trying to find the funds. There are just so many problems with that. So hopefully we can bring that to the legislative session and just keep making people aware of that. Also, just I would like to kind of talk about the flood risk maps and how there just seems to be just not an updated version of flood risk maps. I was talking to one person who had been impacted by Harvey, and she was saying how they judge their flood risk and their elevation levels based on Allison, the hurricane.
Yeah.
Allison. So she said that she would like to see some change in that regard as well, and just a bigger impact or on climate change, just having people just realize that climate change is real, and there's another storm that will be coming, and people just need to realize that.
That's the big thing, isn't it, that there's going to be another storm. But, you know, we have Chanel and the other AmeriCorps Vistas who are working on this on the case.
That's right. And Chanel Kelly, Children at Risk and Save the Children just released a report. So if you're interested on how children are recovering after Hurricane Harvey, they can go to our website and get that information.
Yeah. Chanel Brown from Children at Risk. Thanks, Chanel. And Chanel will be working, helping us with producing the program as well. Mm-hmm. So throughout the year. So that'll be good. Thanks, Chanel, very much
for
what you do
me.
And for all the work that you do and for being on the program. So, hey, coming up next, we're going to be talking with Zenobia Lai, who is the program director for Catholic Charities at the St. Francis Cabrini Center for Immigrant Legal Assistance. That's a mouthful, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So we're going to get an update here in a second on what's going on the border. Mandy, you mentioned that the upcoming legislative session is coming up. A lot of stuff going on, though, right? I mean, it's starting to get super exciting.
We are trying.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversations. I know advocates that we work with are lining up their legislative priorities, making sure that we have the proper data and support to back up policy recommendations for the legislature. So everyone is hard at work. And then there will be elections, right, in early November, and then it'll be pre-filing time. So that's when we hold the elected accountable for what they said they were going to work on next session, right?
Yeah, speaking of elections, we need to get Sabo under the dome with Sabo up on the radio and see what's going on, right?
Yeah, get an update.
Talk to some people, at least get some political insight into what's going on. So have you talked to Sabo lately, by the way?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. Oh, very good. Hey, you ready to do a little bit? Do we have a little theme music? I wonder if we...
No, darling.
Emmalou Harris on the line with us, Zenobi Lai, who is the head of the Cabrini Immigrant Legal Assistance Program over at Catholic Charities. Zenobi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for being on the program with us today. Hey, what's the latest in regards, and I'm going to go to a piece of news, right? I mean, we're hearing about all these kids that are being transported over down to near El Paso to this tent city. Do you have any insight on that, Zenobi? What's going on?
Well, Cabrini covers some of the unaccompanied children's shelter in the Houston area, and we've been noticing that some of the children are being transferred out to San Diego in the El Paso area, in probably starting in June pretty regularly. I don't know if we have more insights than, you know, other than confirming that, yeah, this is what we are noticing.
Yeah, there's a lot going on that I think that people are trying to figure out. So, but for right now, what is the Cabrini Center really focusing on in regards to children?
Well, there are a couple of program areas that touch on children. Like I mentioned earlier, we have an accompanied children program, which is the biggest of the Cabrini Center's program. And we cover the detained work, and we also provide direct representation to the children while they're detained and after they are released. And we also have two small programs to help the sponsors to start the background checks process so that the children can be released to them. And other than an accompanied children, you know, we have a family visa program, we have a general immigration program, and also we have a crime victim program. So children could be the beneficiary of family petition, asylum application, and one program that is just focusing on children and young adults would be the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, ACA program, that we help these young adults, young immigrants who are brought to the United States as children to apply for this immigration protection for a temporary basis.
Zenobi, how hard is it right now when we've seen this family separation happening? I know that a lot of the families haven't been completely united. How big of an issue is that for you guys right now?
It is still a very big issue. So right now, so you probably have read on the news, 400 plus parents have already been deported before we work on reunifying the families. So only children who are separated from parents are being reunified. But, you know, as you probably know, a lot of the unaccompanied children, they came to the United States with older siblings, aunts and uncles, cousins or grandparents, who are the people that actually raised them. But because they are not the biological parents, they remain separated from these family members with whom they come to the United States. And that is still an unsolved issue right now.
It's so hard.
I know. It's very tough, yeah.
So I know one of our biggest partners around the fight on human trafficking is Catholic Charities in regards to services and policy and advocacy. What are some of the conversations that y'all are having right now around human trafficking and victim services?
Well, we are always very concerned, you know, where the child is being trafficked from Central America to the United States or being trafficked after they arrive at the United States. So for example, when we worked with the detained and accompanied children, we provide legal rights presentation to let them understand what maybe some of the immigration relief that they may be eligible for, and we touch on human trafficking as one of the relief. And then we do legal screening to try to figure out who these the child came to the United States with, and whether there is any reason for us to suspect that there may be human trafficking. And then we flag it, and then and hopefully we can file some complaint about it. But for the most part, you know, human trafficking for unaccompanied children is not a huge issue. What is probably a bigger and harder to notice issue is more like children who are trafficked domestically.
Yeah, we've talked about that for a long time, right? I think Catholic Charities was the group that sort of tipped us off on a lot of this. I want to go back to some of the immigrant children, Zenobi, because with this issue, it must be hard from your perspective to say, hey, we're going to help new immigrants to this country. We're going to provide legal services around immigration. Do you feel like sometimes you're targeting yourself? I mean, do you have maybe more attention from ICE and from immigration because you're working with this population?
Well, I don't think personally, you know, we are afraid of that. But we do know, I mean, it's like every 2 days you have new kind of directives coming down from headquarters, right, that target different segments of the immigrant community. And for us who work with, you know, a lot of immigrants who may not have the right documentation, it's always a danger, right, that they may be targeted for one reason or another. For example, with, you know, recently we've been we've been reading in the news, and I don't know if, you know, some of the parents that we work with are directly affected. The ICE are targeting, ICE has been targeting the parents who come forward to seek the release of the unaccompanied children. This is a huge issue. In the past, you know, because we have a fingerprint program that help the potential sponsors to start the background check process. In the past, we were able to inform these parents or sponsors that the information would not be shared with ICE. But now, since June, there's explicit regulation that enable Christopher Jury Salmon, which is the agency overseeing these children, to share information about the sponsors with ICE. So it's very concerning. And we worry that, you know, the sponsors are probably less willing to come forward to the release of these children. And even, you know, if the sponsors are willing, their household members may not be willing to do that. And that, excuse me, that results to, you know, the relocation of these children with an adult in the United States not happening.
Zenobia.
Which causes significant delay and extended detention for the unaccompanied children.
Zenobia Lai is over at Catholic Charities. She's at the Cabrini Immigration Center, working with a large community out there. Zenobia, thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you so much for being on our program today.
Thank you.
All righty,
take care. Thanks. Take care.
You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT, Pacifica Radio 90.1, and Mandy Kimball.
Dr. Sanborn.
Here to serve.
Yeah.
Here we are, right? You ready for a little thumbs up, thumbs down?
Let's do it.
I'm really excited about this. I am ready, 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 let me tell you. And boom.
Woo.
A little boom there.
You always have a big boom, Bob.
Thumbs up, thumbs down. The booming voice of Bob Sanborn.
Thumbs down. That's right. And today we are talking about, should young children fly by themselves?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oftentimes, parents, wouldn't it be great just to send your kids off to go see the grandparents?
Right? Wouldn't it be nice? Just put them on
summer.
A plane.
There you go.
They're going to be well taken care of on the plane. Maybe get a little meal. Maybe some pretzels, some peanuts.
Always get the wings.
They might have an allergy. Get the little wings. Yeah. The pretzels. Stick with the pretzels. Are they allowed to order a drink just to calm them down a little bit, just to take the edge off?
That's
no.
Not appropriate.
No, not appropriate. Not like a little Coke, Coca-Cola.
Yeah, extra caffeine. There shouldn't be any caffeine involved either.
Yeah, no caffeine.
Water.
Juice.
That's right.
No, because juice is full of sugar, so the same sort of thing, right? So we're getting off track, but what do you think, Mandy?
Thumbs up or thumbs down. So I think we need to be smart about this, right? And now I have lots of questions. I know when I was young, I went and flew a couple of times by myself, and they put me up at the beginning or in the front of the airplane.
The front of the plane at the bulkhead, right?
Yeah.
They gave you the little wings.
They gave me the wings, and a few times they let me go and say hello to the pilots.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen at all.
Did they ever let you sit like in the seats, the pilot seats?
No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I was up there talking to him.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was nice and it was great. However, there was a story or an issue.
Yeah, I think Chanel, are you there? Do you want to tell us about that Frontier Airlines? Are you there, Chanel? What happened on Frontier Airlines?
Okay, so there was a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old. They were traveling without their parents on a Frontier Airlines flight from Des Moines to Orlando. However, severe weather caused the plane to be diverted to Atlanta. The children's father said that the airline made the decision to put their children in a hotel room with 4 other unaccompanied minors and an airline employee. He tried to call the gate agents multiple times, but no one answered. The children were transported to the hotel around 2 in the morning using an airline employee's personal vehicle where there was no booster seat for his daughter. The father also said that no one from the airline ever contacted him or the children's mother and said that his son had to borrow another child's cell phone to keep his parents updated.
Wow. Yeah, I know. That's something else, right?
Yep.
So what do you think?
That would not fly with
Chanel, me. You thumbs up or thumbs down letting kids fly alone?
Yeah, I think I'm thumbs up for thumbs letting up. Kids. Yeah, yeah. As I was telling you, so my mom didn't let me fly alone even when I was 18. She was like, I don't want you to fly by yourself. But I think that I feel like this situation, it was a rare situation where there was incompetent staff members, and usually the staff members and the flight attendants, I mean, they usually keep a pretty cautious eye on those unaccompanied minors, so I'm thumbs up.
What do you think, Mandy?
Well, I would want to know what the policies are, right? Yeah. You're not taking my child out of an airport without me knowing and getting my permission. Now, I also understand it's 2 o'clock in the morning. What are you supposed to do? I mean, right. It's great that there were 4 of them and an adult. There probably should have been maybe a couple of adults, I would think, one adult with all these kids. And then you would want to transport them correctly, right? So, I mean, I think as parents, we need to understand what are the expectations, what are the policies, what happens if and when, right? And I don't think it was just the stewardess there. Clearly, there was a policy that allowed them to take those kids without letting you know, and that's just not okay. So, but I mean, I want to be thumbs up to letting kids fly, but we just have to make sure and understand what we're doing. Now, I have another story.
Yeah,
my best friend, and you remember you were on this flight and I didn't know it, but there was really bad weather from Dallas to Houston and the flights kept getting postponed or they were stuck on the ground, couldn't get up and couldn't get off. Well, my best friend's son was supposed to fly from Dallas to Corpus and they were going to land in Houston.
Oh, yeah.
And then he was going to go to Corpus and they canceled the flight. And so she was like a wreck. And luckily, BFF lived here. I went and picked him up and he stayed with me, right? But otherwise, what would have happened?
Yeah.
And he's in middle school, so he's not 7 or 9, but still a situation that we just need to have a game plan when kids are flying by themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And parents need to be part of the game plan, right?
And
you
I have
can't
to say
just
that
hand it over to the flight attendants and say, have a good day.
But I have to say the flight attendant on the plane was giving her son her personal cell phone, and he was able to call his mom throughout the flight when they were just hanging out, which that was nice.
That's really good, right?
Yeah.
So you are overall?
Overall thumbs up, but we just need to be smart about it.
Yeah, I think I'm a thumbs up. I think we live in a day and age when you need to do this. I mean, we need to put pressure on airlines to be better about this. And as parents, you just need to be all over this. But, we have these separated families. We have families that are working in different parts of the country. The reality is that we are a society that flies around a lot, and kids need to be part of this. Now, ideally, right? You want to fly with your kids, but it's going to happen when they're going to have to fly on their own.
That's right. Did you ever fly by yourself?
Yeah, I did. Flew by myself. Yeah.
Were you good?
I remember when I was a freshman in high school. This is a really interesting.
That's a little bit older.
Yeah, I was flying alone, and I remember flying on this little propeller plane from New Haven, Connecticut. And I was flying, I can't remember where I was flying, some other place. But they put me, they closed the door, and they pulled down the seat from the door, and that's where I sat. And I was just like petrified. And I remember
you're going to fall out the door.
Yes. I remember getting off the plane and my aunt was there to meet me. And I feel like my shirt was completely soaked through. And you know, when you're in ninth grade, it's not a sweet smelling sweat, you know? It's just,
yeah.
So
no.
It's
and you still don't like those little planes, do you?
I hate little planes. I hate little planes. So when we fly around the state, you know, I'm always like, I'll take Southwest, you, the big planes around the state. Because still, sometimes you have to take those little planes. I mean, they're so much safer than they used to be, but still.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a, I've been alone on planes, but that's the one that I remember when it was.
That's when you were scared.
Yeah, that was it. So, hey, thank you so much for that thumbs up, thumbs down. And we're all sort of all on the same page, right?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have been doing it for a long time. We just need to be smart about it.
Yeah, if I did it, it's been being done a long time.
Which
right?
I don't remember. I think some airlines now charge you more. I don't know if all of them do or not for younger kids, mm-hmm. which
well, because then the flight attendant has to pay it a little bit extra attention. So
yeah.
Maybe.
Was yeah, it like know. That back in the day?
I don't
know.
No,
they were just nice.
No, I remember flight attendants had to pay a lot of attention. I remember even changing planes and flight attendants walking with me to change planes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never walked by myself.
Yeah.
They escorted me.
So, very good. All right. You ready to talk a little bit about health?
Yes.
I love talking about health, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, we're going to talk about health with Ryan Rampool in just a couple of minutes here. But in regards to health, Mandy, when we look at our city after the hurricane, coming up with the legislative session, I wonder, does our state legislature, are they concerned about the health of Houston's children?
Well, I hope that they are, right? But I don't know if there's been a whole lot of conversations on the impact Harvey has had on kids. Now, I will tell you that right after the hurricane, we had the city and the county coming out saying, hey, these are the preventative things we need to do to make sure that the impact on families' health is not severe, right? And that had to do with like mucking, right?
Yeah.
Mucking the walls and mosquitoes, because there are going to be a bunch of mosquitoes. So let's make sure that we spray, all really important. Right now, I think a lot of what people are focused on is the mental health and behavioral health of these. And so that's some of the conversation that I've heard the legislature talking about. So maybe not necessarily physical health after the hurricane, but more on the behavioral and mental health.
Very good. A little theme music maybe, right? We need a little... It sounds like something Ryan would choose, right?
I like this song.
So love the one you got, cause you might get run over or you might get shot. Never startle static, I just get it off.
On the line with us is Ryan Rampool. He's a senior project manager, government relations over at Texas Children's Hospital. Ryan, how you doing, man?
How's it going, Dr. Bob? I'm doing well.
Very good. Mandy and I are super excited to talk to you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon as well, Mandy.
So, Ryan, I wanted to ask you, you know, you're there at Texas Children's. You guys are sort of the center of health in Houston in many ways, right, for children. When you guys think about sort of the key problems facing our kids in Houston health-wise, what are you guys coming up with, Ryan?
Man, Dr. Bob, that's actually a pretty vast question right there. But one thing I want to point out first before getting into that, like in terms of child health, though, you know, people have to realize that children aren't just small adults.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they have unique needs because they depend on adults for care, but also they differ from adults in physiology, behavior, metabolism, immune system, and of course, most importantly, their perceptions of the world. An event to a child looks a lot different than an event processed by an adult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in that vein, some of the main pediatric health issues that we're studying and that we're experiencing, you can't talk about this subject without mentioning childhood obesity.
Yeah.
You know, the percentage of children and adolescents affected by obesity has more than tripled since the 1970s, according to the CDC. And in Texas, specifically, if you look at Department of Health and Human Services data, about 36% of Texas high school students are overweight or obese, which is up 30% since just 2001. So there's a lot going on there.
And Ryan, when you look at this from like a policy perspective, the sort of the big picture, what can a place like Texas Children's do? What can a group of physicians do in the fight against obesity, childhood obesity specifically?
Okay, so that's an interesting question, because to really address an issue like childhood obesity, it's not just one sector that's going to have to respond. Yes, the health sector can play a part, and I'll give you some examples of how we're doing it, but we have to start thinking more cross-collaboratively. Mm-hmm. these types of issues, childhood obesity, food insecurity, mental health, they're going to require multifaceted approaches from the health sector, from the education sector, from the housing sector. They're all related. But specifically in terms of what Texas Children's is doing, you know, we're doing a lot in that regard. I mean, we're piloting some projects where we work with local organizations like the YMCA to refer some of our clinically, you know, overweight children and obese children to some of these nutrition education programs that they have at the YMCA, one of which is called Your Healthy Weight and Why. It's a very, very interesting program. But my point in saying that one example is that it requires more than just a clinical setting.
Oh, I absolutely agree, Ryan. And I have a question, and you may not have the data on this, but childhood obesity is something that has been discussed for the past 30 years, right? Yeah. But I would think over the last 10, there have been some advances on technology. And so one is, yes, more kids have smartphones, right? And then there's iPads, so get off the screen. On the other side, though, I feel like, what are those things called? The steps? The step meter?
Pedometers?
Pedometers. Pedometers, or the watch, or the Fitbit, or whatever, you know, is educating people. That's the new thing. Stay healthy. How are you active today? Are we seeing any of those make a difference in regards to combating obesity?
No, you know, that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure about the data about whether we've turned a corner. Actually, I don't think the data suggests that we've turned a corner on childhood obesity. I think it's still rising. I do think technology can play a role, especially those pedometers, and more specifically what you mentioned about education, just more knowledge about, you know, how steps translate into burned calories. And most importantly, though, a lot of it's diet as well. Mm-hmm. There are things like genetics, metabolism, sleep habits, but diet, physical activity, you know, and that comes back to what I was saying about multifaceted approach, because what a lot of people don't realize is that certain communities and neighborhood designs are not really conducive to physical activity. Some
right.
neighborhoods aren't safe, so you're not going to go out and try and run around the block. You just come home and you hunker down because it's not really safe to walk. Some communities aren't walkable. You know, they're not designed, you know, to be walkable, and they're not really conducive to physical activity. So we have to start thinking about it from, you know, multiple fields.
Yeah.
Last week, Ryan, we had our big children's summit, and we had some people talking about the incidence of respiratory disease and asthma when you live near a big freeway. I wonder, you know, we have on the east side of town, we have air that sometimes seem a little off because of sort of the petro complex out there. We have the highways coming through our town. We have you know, Hurricane Harvey's environmental impact. What is the incidence of asthma in our city? Is it higher than most other places, or is it about the same?
You know, I don't exactly know if you look at it from the city's perspective what the prevalence of asthma is. I do know that you're absolutely correct. In certain parts of town, it is higher. That's a well-documented fact in the scientific literature that, you know, being around some of the petrochemical areas, you know, it emits PM2.5 and other asthma triggers. Additionally, you know, being next to a highway has been known, proven throughout the literature time and time again, to exacerbate asthma conditions. But it's also other stuff, too. Aged housing stock, the presence of cockroaches, mold, which is, you know, people are really studying the effects of what Hurricane Harvey has done in terms of mold, because that can be, you know, a trigger for asthma. So, yeah, there are definitely environmental triggers to asthma, and there's a lot of research being done on it, but in terms of the city's actual prevalence, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I imagine it'd be high, though.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, we were talking earlier about food insecurity, and you were talking about how we need to have a multifaceted approach or a holistic approach. When oftentimes you have these obese kids, what many people don't realize is that they're food insecure, even though that they don't look like it. When you look at the children in Houston, where do we stand in regards to food insecurity in our youth?
Well, I can tell you about Texas. So, you know, you're right. The USDA defines food insecurity as like when consistent access to adequate food is limited by lack of money or resources during the year. And so, yeah, a lot of people are like, oh, you just told me childhood obesity is on the rise, but also food insecurity is on the rise. That's kind of a weird statement in the same sentence. But if you're wondering about where your next meal is coming from and stuff, you're going to grab onto whatever's cheap, quick, and available. And a lot of times those things are high in calories. They're prepackaged. They're processed foods, high in calories, high in sugar. So in terms of food insecurity for the U.S. About 12 million children in the U.S. are struggling with food insecurity. According to Feeding America, which is a nonprofit group that's aimed at hunger relief, 1.6 million of those children are in Texas, which puts our average significantly higher than the national average for food insecurity. We're only behind New Mexico, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana. We're the fifth highest in terms of childhood food insecurity. I would like to do some more research on, our specific our city's prevalence. I can tell you that we screen at certain Texas Children's Clinics for food insecurity, and our prevalences are similar to what Texas's are.
That's great. One other issue that I wanted to talk about, we talk about mental health and behavioral health often in our kids, and how can we ensure that we have these healthy children. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what's the difference between mental health and behavioral health and what's going on with kids today.
Specifically about the differences between those terms, I don't want to say that I'm like a mental health or behavioral health professional in this. I got to just approach it from what I know working at the hospital. We have psychology services, which is more therapy related. We have psychiatry services, which, deals with medications. And in addition, we have a trauma and grief center, which deals with trauma. So to answer that specific question, I'm not entirely sure, to be quite honest, about the differences between behavioral health and mental health. They are often used interchangeably. I should study that a little bit more.
Yeah. So, but it sounds definitely something that Texas Children's is focusing on with those different services that they provide.
Ryan, after the hurricane, right? This whole center on trauma that you guys launched, that seems to be sort of worth mentioning, right?
Absolutely. Technically we launched it like a month before the hurricane, but the Trauma and Grief Center is
timely,
Dr. Bob. But it really took off after the hurricane. That's what I like to refer to as our community arm of our mental/behavioral health services. In the hospital, we do say mental/behavioral health to describe that kind of section of healthcare. That's our community-based arm. I mean, after Santa Fe, we were down in Santa Fe with the TAG Center. We have a mobile unit that goes and provides mobile mental health services around town. That's really taken off since Harvey. They say that the traumatic effects from an event like Harvey usually manifest themselves 18 months from the event. So we're coming up on that. We're very busy in that regard. Trauma and Grief Center at Texas Children's has really been active.
Oh, yeah. Yep. That's great. And we appreciate it. And we were talking about looking forward to next session. What are some of the issues that we would like the Texas legislature to focus on in regards to health? And I think that there's a real opportunity amongst the behavioral health and mental health. Ryan, I know that you focus a lot on community benefits, right, in Texas Children's. So it's not just only what can we do and how can we serve the children and families that walk into our door, but how can we improve the community in general from preventing them coming in the door? What are some of those efforts that are going on in the Houston area?
Oh, excellent question. So, we're a huge hospital system, and so we actually have a lot of community benefit efforts going on throughout the community, throughout our service area, actually. We have an actual mobile clinic, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's different than the trauma and grief clinic I was telling you about a second ago. But our mobile clinic, they're out in the community every day. You can just Google Texas Children's Mobile Clinic, and they'll have a calendar of places that they'll be. They're usually, I think, at the Children's Museum on Wednesdays. They provide free and low-cost care to anyone that shows up. Additionally, our cardiology department, there's an interesting program going on called Project Adam. We're one of about 30 Project Adam sites across the U.S. And what Project Adam hospitals do is, Adam stands for automatic defibrillators in Adam's memory. They're aimed at making area schools able to respond to a sudden cardiac arrest event. Now, people tend to think, they hear cardiac arrest and they think heart attack and they think elder and they think diet-related conditions. Sudden cardiac arrest affects children, adults. Every time you hear one of those stories in the news about a child, falling down, becoming unresponsive on the football field, a lot of those are sudden cardiac arrest events. So we're working with HISD and the American Heart Association to try and get area schools to be more ready to handle a sudden cardiac arrest event on campus, because it's not a very, you know, well-known condition. And additionally, I just want to mention one tiny pilot project that my department specifically is working on, because it relates...
Did we lose Ryan? I can't hear Ryan anymore. Did we stop Ryan on the line, too?
Oh, no, we must.
for our final four with Ryan. All right. So, Chanel, try to get Ryan back on the line for us so we can do our final four with Ryan. So, at least we have the final four music.
That's right. I will ask you. You hardly ever answer any of these questions.
Let's see.
I don't know if you have. She's gone. Just okay. Tell me, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid? The Army figures? What was yours?
No. I liked Army, man. I also had little Matchbox cars.
Oh, Matchbox.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a big deal, right? All right. Do we have you back, Ryan?
Yes, you do.
Very good. Are you ready for the final four, 54?
Yeah, can we turn the music down a little
bit?
Yeah,
turn the music down a little bit.
Sorry about that, Ryan. Okay. So this is an opportunity for listeners to get to know you a bit better. And the first question that we have, Ryan, is what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
I was a huge Batman fan. I have a bunch of Batman action figures, vintage ones, new ones. I'm a huge Batman fan.
And you still have them,
then,
Ryan?
Then and now. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I do. In fact, I have one of like the old school ones from the 70s still in the box. It's worth thousands right now.
Woo! There we go. Your parents did you right. You wouldn't take them out, huh? Couldn't play with it?
Well, when my dad bought it, it was actually really old. And I was like, no, I want the new one. And so I, by some mistake, I kept it in the box, and I'm glad I did.
That's great. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I wanted to be Indiana Jones. I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Yes. Nice. Yes, very good.
Like a kind of archaeologist like him, like traveling around doing cool adventure stuff like that.
Yeah. What was your favorite book to read as a child?
Man, my favorite book to read as a child. It'll probably be something related to dinosaurs. I had a lot of dinosaur books.
Wow, dinosaur books. And finally, Ryan, what was your favorite TV show as a kid?
Favorite TV show would be Ninja Turtles. Huge Ninja Turtle fan.
And did you have a favorite Ninja Turtle?
Raphael. I used to tell people my name was Raphael.
Did you really?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's great. So I'm hearing you're a big fan then and now as well.
Yeah. I don't like the reboot too much, but, you know, I like the old school Ninja Turtles. They're pretty cool.
Ryan Rampoul is the Senior Project Manager at Texas Children's Hospital and Government Relations Community Benefits. Ryan, thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for being on Growing Up in America today.
Thank you so much, and shout out to my wife, Letha, and my son, Rashawn. Love you guys.
All righty.
Oh, nice.
Take care.
Take care.
Shout out to them as well, right?
Yeah.
So,
his son is a baby. That's an infant baby.
Right.
Nope.
Baby, like baby.
Like,
huh?
I think right after Harvey
was
born.
Very good. Well, Mandy, in our final 40 seconds.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for all that you do.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Chanel, our producer.
Great
Laura,
job.
Laura, our producer, who's on. She sent me a text from Poland yesterday, by the way. Can you believe that?
That's nice.
So that was really nice. And then I want to thank Don, who's out there on the engineering. Hey, hug your kids and watch out for everyone in our community. We do this for children. We hope you do as well. And we will see you next time here on Growing Up in America, which, again, you can get the podcast too, Mandy, by the way.
That's
have you ever
right.
listened to the podcast?
Yeah.
Because you sound fantastic on the podcast.
Trying to keep up with you.
So get that on iTunes or your favorite place. We'll see you next time here on Pacifica Radio.